Comparing nuclear buttons. It's the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump takes to Twitter yet again to rattle North Korea. But does it really matter whose nuclear button is bigger?
The parable of the naked emperor sometimes arises when you think about these tweets and this very unpresidential behavior by Donald Trump. And do we become so accustomed to it that we forget at times to point out that there's sort of this big naked guy in the room?
Plus, stuck in the Balkans, refugees from the Middle East and North Africa try to find a place to fit in.
We are getting frustrated. We have no future. We don't know what will happen with us. And sometimes we feel that we are treated worse than animals.
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. My button is bigger than your button. That's pretty much what President Trump tweeted at North Korea's Kim Jong-un last night. To be fair, Kim started it, boasting on New Year's Day that his nuclear button was on his desk all the time. But now, after that tweet, it's Trump's response that is everyone's attention.
We can't reliably claim to be surprised by it because he's had many examples of inflammatory tweets throughout the course of the first year. But at the same time, it's actually shocking, right? This is not how any president ever has conducted public diplomacy.
That's how Politico columnist Susan Glasser is reacting to President Trump's tweet about having a bigger nuclear button. Glasser paints a chilling portrait of White House politics in her latest story for Politico. It's called Donald Trump's Year of Living Dangerously. And it begins with a description of President Trump's dinner meeting with the leaders of four Latin American countries last September.
Trump had already threatened the quote-unquote military option in Venezuela in August, the same famous press conference where he talked about fire and fury against North Korea, and so people didn't focus on Venezuela. But of course, these Latin American leaders remembered it. Well, Trump opens up this dinner meeting and basically says, Rex Tillerson, sitting right next to me, Rex tells me that you guys don't want me to use the military option in Venezuela. Is that right? Are you sure?
Wow.
And they found the interaction to be stunning. I spoke with someone who was briefed by leaders from three of the four countries that attended, who told me the word that they all used after this dinner with the President of the United States was, this guy is insane.
And what were they reacting to? Just as kind of like old-time retail politics? Is that what baffled them?
No matter how well prepared they were, and obviously it was 8 months into this extraordinary presidency, so they were well prepared, but no matter how prepared they were, they found the president's loose talk of a military option in Venezuela shocking, even if they realized that probably President Trump was not going to be going to war in Venezuela. And I think more broadly, the president's combination of what seemed to be lack of deep knowledge about the region combined with making preemptive demands on countries that are neighbors and partners and allies of the United States was something really extraordinary to them.
One of your sources actually said, quote, it's worse than you think, unquote. What did they mean?
Well, you know, I've actually heard that from many people, in fact, over the course of the last year. And one of my goals in writing this article to really step back and look at the first year of Trump was to capture that reality. The people I've spoken with inside the national security world, inside the foreign policy world, the closer that they have been to interacting with President Trump in some way, the more that you tend to hear accounts of, like, you have no idea what's really going on, or it's worse than you think. And these are people who are not partisan political actors. It's not about having a particular ideology or agenda. I've spoken with people of all sorts of political persuasions over the last year, and almost to a person, they have offered accounts like this.
So in the news today, we've got the possibility of talks between North and South Korea in the midst of some real anxiety-provoking stuff. What do you think it tells us that the North is looking to the South, just as the U.S. reiterates its mistrust of Kim Jong-un and says it doesn't think this outreach is going to work?
You know, in 2017 was really a year of world leaders, including Kim Jong-un, trying to understand Donald Trump, trying to figure out and take the measure of the man. I think 2018, we're going to see leaders taking action based on their assessments of Trump. And I think that the North's overture to South Korea probably fits into that category, sensing perhaps correctly that Donald Trump is not exactly really invested in America's traditional alliances and partnerships with countries like South Korea, and that there is opening to be had for those who are looking to divide the United States from its partners, at least partially because of Trump's own rhetoric.
Well, let's continue this example of North Korea, because Secretary of State Tillerson and Secretary of Defense Mattis have been encouraging these talks that may happen between North Korea and South Korea. Why does Trump seem to be ignoring that advice?
Well, as we have seen pretty clearly, Trump takes his own counsel. He gets advice. Sometimes he listens to it, but often he disregards it. And consistently, he has been publicly skeptical of negotiations. He also seems to want to be, of course, in the middle of every story. And Trump doesn't like a negotiation to which he's not a party. And he may be being cut out of the North Korea conversation in a way he finds unacceptable.
Look at the Iran nuclear deal. Secretary of State Tillerson and James Mattis, again, they want Trump to stick with it. Trump seems inclined to decertify it. I mean, it's a huge issue. And if you're at the level of Tillerson or Mattis, you either learn to agree or you resign, laying out your values for the world to see. What does it tell us that neither of these men seem inclined to resign?
Well, again, the history of this unique period in American politics will be written not this year. So we don't exactly know what's in their mind yet. For now, there are many people who believe that Mattis and Tillerson are there because they have made a decision to remain in these positions and to try to shape and curb Donald Trump as long as possible. Is this really a sort of public service mission, suicide mission, if you will? Tom Wright from Brookings, who I spoke with, who's a very smart observer, said to me for this article that he thinks people like Mattis and Tillerson are maybe the first time in history that advisors have gone in to an administration to constrain or to stop the president rather than to enable him.
Have you seen Darkest Hour yet, the story of Winston Churchill on the eve of Great Britain taking on the
No, I haven't, but I heard it's terrific.
What'll strike you is that it's 2 hours of classic statesmanship. And I was just wondering, for a political journalist and writer like yourself, Susan, what is it like to be writing not about a Churchillian type character, but something that looks more like Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass? Kind of surreal.
You know, every morning we wake up and there is a sense of pinch yourself. Can you believe some of the sentences that we're writing? You know, the parable of the naked emperor sometimes arises when you think about these tweets and this very unpresidential behavior by Donald Trump. And do we become so accustomed to it that we forget at times to point out that there's sort of this big naked guy in the room?
Give us a little advice for the coming year, Susan. The tweets are dramatic. They're made for TV practically, and they're distracting. What should we really be paying attention to?
Look, I do believe you have to pay attention to the tweets. This is unfiltered access to the id of the president of the United States. And as he's shown in his policy decisions and willingness to overrule his advisors, you better pay attention to what he thinks. Of course, it's an erratic and unpredictable guide. But I think anybody who thinks Donald Trump is going to change his ways and become suddenly more presidential in a conventional sense is crazy.
Susan Glasser, Chief International Affairs Columnist for Politico. Always good to speak. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's hear a little more now about North and South Korea reestablishing official communications. The North cut off talks with its southern neighbor in 2016. Those communications were done partly through special hotlines. And today, the two sides got on the phone for the first time in 2 years. We asked Joel Witt what he makes of today's call. He's a former State Department official who negotiated with the North Koreans in the 1990s.
I don't think they got into much substance in the initial talk, but I think the first priority will be to try to work it out so the North Koreans can participate in the upcoming Olympics. And of course, everyone hopes that that will lead to steps taken by both sides to lessen the tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
Do you see the goal here eventually to have Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in of South Korea talk to each other at some point?
Well, of course, that's always the holy grail for the South Koreans. They want to have another North-South summit. But I think that that is probably far down the road. There are a number of things that can be done way before then that would improve the atmosphere between the two. For example, South Korea might start providing humanitarian assistance to the North and some other steps the South Koreans could take to improve economic relations. So it's a long road ahead, and it's not guaranteed they'll ever get to that.
I mean, just in the present, though, how will the Trump White House see this move?
Well, of course, that's the big question. And everyone's saying this is meant to drive a wedge between Washington and Seoul, because President Trump is obviously hell-bent on his strategy of maximum pressure on North Korea. So it could very well drive a wedge. But what the U.S. administration should be doing, it should be thinking about using this initiative to its own advantage. And by that, I mean working with the South Koreans to launch some sort of joint initiative that would encourage dialogue with North Korea and exploring the serious security issues that are facing us.
Is the White House doing enough in that direction? Aren't we even absent an ambassador in South Korea at the moment?
Well, I don't think that really matters whether there's an ambassador in South Korea. What really matters is that the White House needs to be thinking about where its current policy is leading us. And I think the policy of maximum pressure and imposing additional sanctions on North Korea, while maybe justified because of their behavior, is going to lead to a dead end. And so the administration should be thinking about how to add to that policy. Of course, we should be skeptical, but that doesn't mean we can't use this initiative to our own advantage. And at the end of the day, if the North Koreans back away or prove that this was just a tactical move, then we end up looking pretty good with others who are watching, such as the Chinese, whose support we really do need if we want to keep ramping up pressure.
Right. So you're saying there's an opportunity. Take it. What has China said about Kim's decision to reestablish communications?
Well, I think the Chinese have been very supportive. And all along, I know behind the scenes, they've been trying to nudge him to move forward. But, you know, the North Korean-Chinese relationship is not good at all. And so the Chinese will tell you their ability to influence Kim has become much more limited than under his father, when they had a much better relationship.
So earlier you were saying that opening up these communication lines could lead to North Korea participating in the Olympics. What other dividends could you see coming after that?
Well, I think that's a first step in a potential process that leads to lessening tensions on the peninsula. But the point here is that that dialogue may not get very far without U.S. participation, because, of course, everyone understands the key issues are, you know, the nuclear issue and the missile issue. And to have a serious discussion on that issue, those issues, the United States has to be part of the mix, because the North Koreans see the United States as their main enemy.
Joel Witt, former State Department official, now a senior fellow at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
From telephone hotlines to the big red button, it occurs to me that many of us who are children of the Cold War see this stuff in our dreams, right? You must have had your own education about the bomb and the danger of nuclear annihilation. Did you live through the Cuban Missile Crisis? Did you watch Dr. Strangelove and learn about rogue generals and top secret codes? Or are you a post-Cold War newcomer to the whole concept of what nuclear war can do? Feel free to let us know on Twitter. We're at PRI The World, and I'm at Marco Werman. We'll have more later in the show about that big red nuclear button, like, does it actually exist? You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We are big believers here at the show in following up on big stories and hearing from those who actually lived those events, describing what happened in their own words. It's part of an occasional series here on the show that we're calling First Person. Today, we've got a story about surviving the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014. In July of that year, Dr. Udura Okoli was working at a medical center in Lagos, Nigeria. She cared for an American Liberian patient named Patrick Sawyer, who'd been admitted with a fever and body aches. Sawyer had just been to Liberia, where the Ebola outbreak was peaking, but in Lagos, no Ebola cases yet, and he was misdiagnosed. By the time Sawyer died from the disease 5 days later, Dr. Okoli had contracted Ebola, and she spent the next 2 weeks in quarantine with other Ebola patients.
You don't know if you're going to be here for 10 days, 20 days, 5 days, and you don't know if you're going to leave in a body bag or if you're going to leave with your two legs walking out of the ward. And that's the part that it's just you're waiting, and 24 hours feels like 5 days. You're not sure. that's the part that's devastating. And then when you see that someone who was next to you is dead, you're wondering who's going to be the next person to die. We were not allowed to cross the door. That's how trapped we were in the room. And if people came to see us, they could only see us from across the window. And they couldn't come close. And the nurses never handed our food to us, you know, directly. They dropped the food at the door. And we had a couple of people who heard about the outbreak and somehow knew that that was where we were being treated. And they would gather around the isolation ward trying to peep into the room because they didn't want to come close because it's the Ebola ward. But they wanted to know and see who was in there and to see if maybe we had blood coming out of our noses or, you know, just wanted to know out of curiosity what this Ebola thing is about. The night of that second day, somebody was walked into the ward. She was crying. She was in tears. And it turns out that that was Justina, the nurse that I had sent to go and clip Patrick Sawyer's IV. And I felt so sorry because she was pregnant at the time, but she came into the ward bleeding. And I knew what that meant. It meant that she had lost her pregnancy. You know, that part where I started to think that if I didn't send her to go and clip the IV, maybe she wouldn't be here. But then, honestly, how do we know what's going to happen? We're just doing our jobs. We're just doing what we know we should do. I had that feeling of guilt, and you know, it was just a very, very bleak situation, and we just didn't know what the end was going to be, but I had to be hopeful. Interestingly, when I was on the ward, there was that that unspoken thing that don't let anybody know that you have Ebola. So I couldn't talk to friends. I could only talk to those people who knew, my parents and my pastor. No one else. How can you call your friend and say, hey, I'm on the ward, I have Ebola? You know, and so I was isolated in the fact that I couldn't speak to people, just my family members, and not just any family members, my mom, my dad, my brother. At a point, I didn't want my parents to come see me. I didn't want them to see how weak I was during the first couple of days, because they would come and see me and my mother would weep. But seeing them showed me that they were not sick, which was one of my fears. Because there was a time that she touched me when I was sweating and she wanted to feel my temperature. And that could have been a point of, you know, infection for her. So I had flashbacks of that moment while I was on the ward, and I kept praying, God, please don't let my mother be infected. If I have to die for her to be alive, I don't mind. The main thing I did was I researched online. I'll go on my iPad and I'll check. I wanted to know everything there was to know about the former Ebola outbreaks. I want to know about those people that survived and what they were doing with their lives. I wanted to know how they overcame. I wanted to know what drugs they took. I wanted to know how hydrated they had to be. So out of 10 people that have Ebola, 1 to 5 are going to survive. So who's it going to be? How do we choose who survives? It was just so many questions and not enough answers. I remember vomiting at least 8 times a day or more, but I knew the diarrhea was about more than 12 times a day. But on the 5th or 6th day of my admission, I noticed that my feces was starting to get semi-solid as opposed to watery. And that was the first sign of, something is happening. That was when I started, you know, feeling like there was going to be light at the end of the tunnel, and I was starting to get my strength back little by little. On the 7th day of my admission, I was told that we were going to be moving to a new ward, and that was actually the day that Justina died. That was when I started to, you know, really become afraid, because Justina had a period when she started getting better and then she all of a sudden deteriorated and got worse and died. So I was worried, you know, maybe I'm getting better, maybe I'm going to get worse and die. I was speaking to my pastor on the phone and I said, you know what, I'm tired. He said, no, don't say you're tired. Don't say you're tired. This is not the time for you to be discouraged. This is the time for you to hold on. Hold on. You've been holding on. Hold on. And so I wept and I just kept quiet and he prayed. And after he prayed, I prayed and I got my strength back. One morning, 14 days after I had been admitted, my blood tested negative to Ebola. When I got the information, I was battling severe joint aches and pains, but I jumped. I jumped for joy. And I called my mom, I called my pastor, I called my dad and let them know that they were going to have to start coming to the hospital to pick me. But they gave some conditions. They had to come with a new set of clothing, new shoes, and everything they had come with, money, phones, iPads, bags, wedding ring, earrings, every single thing that I came with was going to have to be left behind and was going to be burnt. I got to the front of the ward and everybody was shouting and clapping and there was a red tape and I was given a scissors to cut the tape and that was significant for me because it was a symbol of my survival and my freedom. They all jumped at me, hugged me. Nobody cared if I had Ebola. Just wanted to hug me. That's all. Nobody cared. Even if I didn't have the chlorine bath, even if I had the virus dripping all over my face, my parents would still have hugged me.
Nigerian doctor Adora Okoli contracted Ebola in 2014 and survived. She later moved to New Orleans. That's where she lives now. Thanks to producer Andrea Rangecroft and the BBC podcast Shortcuts for sharing her story. I'm Marco Werman. Mosquitoes aren't just pests. They are some of the most active killers on the planet. But this scientist has a plan to defeat them with cell phones.
Those places in the world where the mobile network is growing fastest are the same exact places that have the maximum amount of mosquito-borne disease.
That story is still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The anti-government protests in Iran may well continue in the days ahead, but it seems that today, at least, activism belonged to the counter-protesters. Thousands of pro-government demonstrators marched through the streets of Tehran, and the head of one of Iran's most powerful institutions, the Revolutionary Guard, declared, quote, the end of the sedition. He also noted that many of the anti-government protesters had been arrested. Karim Sajapour with the Carnegie Endowment has been keeping close tabs on the situation in Iran.
A map I saw last night of the protests showed that in almost the entirety of Western Iran, there are small-scale insurrections, kind of minor protests. It's in contrast to the summer of 2009 in Iran, where you had hundreds of thousands, if not over a million people take to the streets in the city of Tehran. These protests are scattered throughout the country. They don't have the same scale, but their geographic scope is much wider. And it's more difficult in some ways for the regime to quell dozens of protests throughout the country in contrast to, say, one large protest in Tehran.
You kind of singled out Western Iran as a place where a lot of these protests are happening, although you did say it's happening all across the country. But Western Iran, why is that significant?
First of all, Western Iran, if you look at the landscape, it's just larger population centers there. But the reason I cited that is for a couple additional reasons. Number one, there are towns and provinces in Western Iran which are more ethnically and religiously diverse. So you have a large Kurdish population in Western Iran. About 10% of Iran's population are Kurds. And you also have a small Arab minority in Western Iran in the province of Khuzestan. And the reason why Khuzestan province in particular is so important is because over 80% of Iran's oil and gas reserves are in that province. And so it's a place in which you have around 2 million ethnically Arab Iranian. Some of them are Sunni rather than majority Shiite. And they've had these long-held grievances against the Islamic Republic. And if you go in and you crush that population, and then it further inflames the situation, and protests somehow debilitate Iran's oil production or disrupt Iran's ability to produce oil, that's deeply detrimental to the regime's pocketbooks. And it was the oil strikes in 1978 which helped bring down the Shah of Iran.
So in some of those smaller cities and towns where there are protesters, where is their anger being directed?
The anger is always being directed at the regime and the supreme leader. It's remarkable how strident the slogans have been. In 2009, people protested against the tainted re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and they said, "Where is my vote?" That was the big slogan of 2009. This time around, people are calling for death to the supreme leader, an end to the Islamic Republic. And what's remarkable about this is that a lot of these towns are actually quite religious, quite traditional. So these towns were once thought to be kind of the constituents who actually brought the Islamic Republic to power in 1979. So this is tricky for the regime to crush these protests, because it's not like they're crushing a group of liberal middle class Tehran residents who never liked the Islamic Republic anyway. These are constituents who are thought to be people who really like the Islamic Republic, and going in and overwhelmingly crushing them could have consequences for the regime.
Right. Let me just ask you one more thing about one of your tweets from yesterday, especially apt right now since we are two men talking about Iran. You wrote, "It is often male analysts insensitive to the indignities of women living in Iran who claim that protests are solely driven by economic frustration." Do you see evidence that women are at the forefront of these protests?
Some of the most compelling and poignant and powerful interviews I've seen of street protesters have been women. But obviously they're, you know, at somewhat of a physical disadvantage when you have all male Revolutionary Guards and Basij out there with arms and batons, and they will go after women. When I lived in Iran prior to 2009 and I observed some of these political protests as an analyst, I saw female journalists. There was Nazila Fatih from the New York Times and Farnaz Fastihi from the Wall Street Journal. Both of them were beaten with batons. So this isn't a regime which will spare female protesters.
He's a policy analyst at the Carnegie Endowment. Karim Sajapour, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This week, we're checking in on Europe's migrant situation. A couple of years ago, large numbers of migrants trekked from the Middle East to Europe, hoping for asylum in places like Germany. It was then called a crisis. Things have changed since then. The European Union made a deal with Turkey to try to stop the flow of people into Greece. Other countries closed their borders and put up fences, and many migrants ended up trapped somewhere along the route. Yesterday, we heard from migrants hiding to avoid deportation on the Greek island of Lesbos. Today, the world's Richard Hall reports from the town of Šid on the Serbia-Croatia border, where a similar situation is playing out.
You'd be forgiven for thinking that this is a celebration, but it's more a rare moment of escape. About two dozen men are trying to keep warm on a freezing night in this empty building. They're living their very own Groundhog Day. Almost every night they try to cross the border into Croatia, and every time they are pushed back by police.
It's impossible.
That's Sergei. He would only give his first name. He worked as a translator in his home country of Afghanistan before fleeing violence there 2 years ago, when he was 26. He's been traveling the migrant trail for 2 years and stuck in Šid for the past 6 months.
The situation is very backward here. Nobody doesn't want to stay in Serbia because of that.
About once a week, dozens of young migrants get together and sing and hang out here. They try to forget their problems for an hour or two. I was last in Šid in 2015 at the height of Europe's migrant crisis. I watched thousands of men and women, young and old, file through the huge cornfields that line the border into Croatia and the European Union. Back then, volunteers gave out juice and doctors were on hand for first aid. Since the Balkan route was shut off last year, people aren't moving anymore. Europe has closed its doors, and Serbia has become a giant holding pen. more than 7,000 refugees and migrants are stuck here. Here's Sergei again.
Many times and I went to the Croatia, and more than 60, 65 times I've got, you know, well, there with the Croatia, even the Slovenia, I crossed these borders. But, you know, well, the Croatian police and the Slovenian police, they catch me and brought me back here to the Serbia. I'm stuck here.
The migrants call it the game, and it's one they always lose. The few still trying to make it across this way are mostly young men traveling alone from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Algeria, and Morocco. They don't have any money. If they did, they would pay for a smuggler, as many others do. They are frustrated and tired. Many of them live in tents in a forest near the border. Some have turned to alcohol and drugs to ease the pain. Among the group I meet in Shid, one of them has a sling on his arm. Another has a large bruise on his face. Both of them say the Croatian police are responsible. NGOs have documented dozens of cases where migrants were sent back like this. Sometimes these pushbacks, as they are called, can have deadly consequences. I meet Muslima Hassini from Afghanistan in a cafe a little way down the road from the border. In November last year, she lost her six-year-old daughter Medina while trying to cross into Croatia. She says she crossed the border with six of her 10 children. They reached the other side in the late evening when it was dark. They thought they had made it, but Croatian police spotted them and told them to turn around. Muslima begged them to let the family stay overnight, but she says the police sent them back, directing them along a railway line. And then the worst happened. Medina was struck by a train that no one saw coming. She can't tell the story without crying. Medina's 17-year-old sister, Nilab, is devastated too.
Why do you think we're animals? We also have life. We come for good life. Why? If you want good future, a peaceful life, what's the problem in that? We are guilty. Because of that, we want a good life. I think no.
The incident drew attention to the Croatian policy of pushing people back across the border. Rights groups say the practice is illegal, and it only fuels the sense of desperation among the migrants. I sense that desperation in everyone I meet in Shid. Adela Al-Sharua hates that people talk about the border crossings as a game.
It's insane to call it game because there are people dying. And I'm just wondering who was so sick to call that game, because this is not game.
Sharua is a dual Syrian Czech citizen, and some in her own family have travelled the migrant trail. Now, she runs a charity that washes clothes for migrants in the town, among other things. Most aid groups are set up to help families, women and children, but a lot of her work is focused on helping the young, vulnerable men at the back of the line. She calls the men travelling alone singles, and she worries about the consequences of leaving them all out here with no hope.
What I heard not only once, many times, even in Greece, when singles were telling me that you as a Europe, you are growing the terrorists in here because we are getting frustrated. We have no future. We don't know what will happen with us. And sometimes we feel that we are treated worse than animals.
She says the problem here is that Europe doesn't have the political will to deal with the ongoing migrant crisis in a humane way. The fear of more migrants arriving outweighs any concern for the well-being of people stuck in Shid. Until that changes, she says, no one wins this game. For The World, Richard Hall in Shid, Serbia.
All right, let's get back to our top story today, North Korea and President Trump's tweet bragging that his nuclear button is bigger than Kim Jong-un's in North Korea. And you know what? I can almost see that button in my mind. It's big and red, and it sits under a glass cover on the president's desk in the Oval Office. I'm sure you've seen it, too, in movies, cartoons, TV shows. But nuclear policy expert Joe Cirincione has some news for us.
As far as I know, there's no red button anywhere, even when you get down to the missile silos or the tubes on the subs. We're talking about switches and keys that launch these missiles. No red button. Sorry.
There is this thing called the nuclear football. What is that?
Ah, Yeah, that's the briefcase that follows the president of the United States everywhere he goes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So when Donald Trump is tweeting in his White House bedroom, there's an officer sitting right outside the door with this briefcase. When President Trump gets on an elevator, the military officer is required to get on the elevator with him. He can never be more than 1 minute away. And what he's carrying is the communications information and the codes for launching nuclear attacks. It's actually a binder that the officer will pull out that gives the President of the United States a menu of options so that he can launch one or 1,000 nuclear weapons on his command.
Having a briefcase, though, I mean, the football, didn't President Clinton once lose it for a couple of months? I mean, how secure are these things?
The football itself, the briefcase, is handcuffed to the military officer who carries it around.
Wow.
But what happens is the president carries around a small credit card size card that they call the biscuit, and that has his codes in it. Say President Trump decides this afternoon that he's had enough and he wants to send a nuke to North Korea. He would summon over the military officer, tell him to open up the briefcase. He would take the binder out and he'd say, I want option Delta Charlie Bravo. And the officer would put him in touch with the military command authority by phone. And the military command authority would then ask to validate the order. Is this really the president? And he would issue the president a challenge code. And the president would have to pull out that card, that biscuit, and give him the proper response.
Yeah, so what happened with Clinton's missing the biscuit for a couple of months?
Several people have misplaced that biscuit. President Carter lost it for a little while, sent it to in his jacket to the dry cleaners. Apparently, the story goes that President Clinton lost it for several months somewhere, somehow, and didn't tell anybody about it. Didn't need it, fortunately, but finally fessed up and they gave him a new one.
You know, Joe, you walked us through that process of launching a strike with such simplicity, but it is serious, deadly serious business. Is there anybody in this administration who would step in and say, no, this is not going to happen? Essentially, I don't know, it's staging a coup.
People don't believe me when I tell them that no one can stop the president once he gives the order. But you have to understand the system was set up during the Cold War to ensure that no one would stop the president. It was designed to be quick and decisive. The whole idea was that this would happen while we were under attack, that we would get notice of Soviet missiles streaking over the pole. And we had tens of minutes to launch hours before they got hit. So the whole thing is set up to be as automated as possible while still involving some level of human control.
So in a way, there might as well be a big red button. Maybe that's why it persists.
Yeah, he's got to go through a few more hoops, but it can happen very quickly. It would take minutes for him to connect to the command authority, and then 4 minutes after the order was given, the missiles would fly. President Nixon famously said during his impeachment crisis, trying to impress people how important it was, he said that I can go into my office, pick up the phone, and in 20 minutes, 70 million people would be dead.
I always get a little spike of anxiety when I speak with you, Joe, but I really appreciate your thoughts. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I'm sorry I couldn't be more reassuring.
Joseph Cerencioni is president of the Plowshares Fund. The sound of a mosquito buzzing nearby can set a lot of us on edge. In many parts of the world, it can also make people fear for their lives. That's because mosquitoes can carry some of the deadliest diseases anywhere, like malaria and dengue. But now that sound might also be able to help people around the world track outbreaks and maybe put an end to them. Here's reporter Ray Allen Bichelle.
Over the last few years, Hari Priya Mukundarajan has gotten intimately acquainted with the world's most efficient killers.
It's this particular species of mosquito that kills almost 500,000 people every year.
And here is its close relative in India. This is the one that probably gave Mukundarajan malaria back when she was in college.
I had the worst headache ever. I didn't know my head could hurt that badly. That's been the only time when I really feared that I might not make it to see the next day.
Mukundarajan is now a bioengineer at Stanford, and she's hoping to help keep other people from getting sick from mosquitoes.
What we really need is lots and lots of data on how to find them. Where and how and when are they biting people to make them sick? And this is data that's extremely difficult to collect.
Most mosquito maps are either indirect, like predictions of where mosquitoes might breed based on satellite images, or they're patchy. In fact, there's a saying that current mosquito maps just show where the entomologists are, not the bugs. But Mukundarajan and her colleagues realized they might be able to solve that problem by using an everyday tool.
So that's why we went for our cell phones.
People everywhere have cell phones. On top of that, she says,
those places in the world where the mobile network is growing fastest are the same exact places that have the maximum amount of mosquito-borne disease.
The idea, says Mukundarajan, is for people around the world to hold off on squashing mosquitoes for a few seconds and instead whip out their phones and record the sound of the bug for just a second or two.
And send that recording to us.
Because here's the thing.
When they beat their wings to fly, they beat it at a certain number of times every second. And that's what we hear as that annoying buzzing whine of the mosquito.
And those annoying buzzes actually sound different because different species flap their wings at different speeds. It's how they find their mates. So mosquito researchers could compare cell phone recordings against their own database of mosquito recordings to help identify the species. And they could use time and location data from the phone recordings to narrow it down further. For example, some mosquitoes have different biting schedules.
The malaria mosquito mostly bites at night, while the Zika and dengue mosquito, it's like a toddler on sugar, it just goes throughout the day.
With a sense of which mosquitoes are where, health officials might be able to, for example, spray pesticides in the specific area where they're breeding, or distribute bed nets in the right neighborhood so that fewer people get sick. They might even be able to help track how the range of some mosquitoes and the diseases they can carry are changing in response to climate change.
That's an important point for the future because there are plenty of regions of the world that are getting warmer, and this means that mosquito habitats are expanding.
It's really wonderful stuff.
That's Aubrey Moore, an entomologist at the University of Guam who is not involved in Mukundarajan's project. Moore worked on identifying mosquitoes using sound in the 80s, and he says the idea goes back a lot farther.
People have been suggesting you can use wingbeat frequency for identifying insects for a long time, and it's just recently that the cheap, ubiquitous equipment is available to us for doing that.
But one problem, Moore says, is that some mosquito species sound really similar and could be in the same place at about the same time. So to tell them apart, you'd have to be able to pick up on more than just their buzz, which the cell phone project can't do. But there are other groups working on mosquito ID methods that can.
I'm Eamon Kyo, a professor of computer science at the University of California, Riverside.
Eamon Kyo's method of identifying mosquitoes harkens back to a James Bond-style spy technique.
When you speak in your office, the window vibrates ever so slightly.
So apparently, Cold War spies could, for example, shine a laser on an embassy window and reconstruct a conversation inside based on subtle vibrations.
Essentially, you can kind of spy on insects by doing this trick with a light.
Kyo and his colleagues have built light sensors that can detect not only a bug's wingbeat frequency, but also things like the height an insect is flying at, its direction and speed.
We can even tell you if you've recently had a blood meal.
The idea is to set up a bunch of these sensors in places where mosquitoes are a problem and have them report back in real time which bugs are flying past. But those kinds of sensors are a lot less common than cell phones, which brings us back to Hari Priya Mukundarajan's project. She calls it a buzz, and she says it's not just an idea anymore.
We've got recordings from Tajikistan, for instance, we've got them from Malaysia, we've got them from across the United States, Brazil.
The group recently published their methods in the journal eLife after field trials in the US and Madagascar, and have begun collecting sound files on their webpage. And, just for fun, the group hired a composer to make this. A song from mosquito sounds.
We deal with mosquito sound. It can't be all bad. There has to be something awesome coming out of it, right? I mean, they sound so sci-fi and so jazzy.
For The World, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Okay, maybe it's my imagination, but after hearing that story about cell phones and mosquitoes, I swear I hear some buzzing in the background of this next tune by the band Mosquitoes. Todo fogo, caro faro, custe extinguir. O tato matou, tomou materno, materno. Entende, gente, inteligente. Então entranha. Manhã, manhã, tanta gente pente, pente. Às vezes se se pega sorrindo. Or maybe it's some subliminal messaging, given the band's name. The song is from Mosquito's new album called Mexican Dust. Michael Leonard, their co-producer on the album, describes the music as a micro-universe of Tropicalia punk folk. I really couldn't describe it any better. Singer Juju Stulbach is originally from Brazil, but she and her fellow band member Chris Root both call New York City and Oaxaca, Mexico, home. The third member of the group, John Marshall, found a place in the mountains of North Carolina, as you would. Bits of the album were recorded and mixed in all three locations. It's a time-intensive process, I'm sure. Might explain why this is the band's first album in 10 years, but it is great to have Mosquitoes back. We'll close with another of the new tracks from Mexican Dust. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.